Dear Eric, I'm leaving this letter in one of our secret places, so Mom and Dad won't find it. Don't let them see that I wrote to you before I left, or they'll never leave you alone about it. Don't worry about me. I'm fine. In fact, I'm better than fine. If I tell you about it, will you promise not to worry about me? Remember when we were little and we lived in the country before Dad got his new job? How we used to go out and play in the woods behind the house? We pretended that we were heroes out in the wilderness looking for lost treasures and dragons to slay, and the big rock out by the stream that had all the moss growing on it always turned into a fort, and we had to defend it from the hordes of monsters that would come to conquer us. Eric, we were right. There's another world out there. We knew it, even then, and I've been there again. And that's where I've gone. Now, before you decide that I'm completely nuts, please, just keep reading and hear me out, okay? It's an incredible story, but I swear to you it's true.
Mr. and Mrs. Shaughnessy, you did the right thing in bringing your child's letter to my attention. Anton Stark, Stark Psychiatric Evaluation Institute.
Welcome to the first episode of Walking Away from Arcadia, a Changeling the Dreaming podcast. I'm Victor Kinzer, and my co-host is Simon Eichhornchen, who can say hello for himself.
Hello, I am Simon Eichhornchen.
First, we just kind of want to talk about what is this crazy podcast thing that we are doing. I had the idea, and I pitched it to Simon, like a month ago, about now, doing a Changeling the Dreaming podcast. There's a lot of World of Darkness podcasts out there, but they'll talk about Changeling occasionally, but I haven't really been able to find much content that really dives into Changeling, and we spend more time talking about it than we probably, you know, would admit in mixed professional company.
No.
No. So I thought, hey, let's talk about it and share our thoughts, and, you know, I know that I've learned way more about this game talking with Simon about it. So I thought, yeah, we could start doing episodes and picking the game apart and have it be something that's, you know, useful for people that they can listen to. And, hey, here's a good intro to what this Changeling thing is. And, hey, here's a good intro to what these, you know, Nunahi characters are all about, et cetera, et cetera. You know, what, Simon, what were you hoping to get out of this or accomplish with it?
Well, I think I think that Changeling kind of suffers from its development cycle and from a really negative reaction from the fan base. And it has this kind of redheaded stepchild thing going on in the World of Darkness kind of broadly. So I'm hoping that we can create kind of a reference for other people who might want to play it, but get a little bit bogged down in some of the more arcane details, like, why have chimerical reality? Or, well, why does this seem quite as racist as it seems?
Well, okay, let's be fair. World of Darkness, that's not a Changeling problem.
No, I think it gets a little bit more leeway in the products people like a little bit better.
Yeah, sometimes. And I mean, and to their credit, I mean, the people working on World of Darkness now are working awfully hard to do better, fix that, move in a better direction. But because Changeling hasn't been touched since the original line, that will be changing soon, you know, we haven't really gotten to see what the burden of their experience can do for Changeling. I have fingers crossed and hopes. And as we all know, playing Changeling, hope leads to tragedy. So,
yes. Flaming, interesting tragedy.
Yes. So, yeah, I mean, those are definitely similar goals. That kind of leads into our first topic. This episode is just an introduction to Changeling, subtitled The World of Stormy Pinkness, which is a quote from one of my dear friends that does not hold this game in high esteem. And I'm really hoping we can clear away some of the misty dreck that gives it that reputation. So, yeah, first topic we wanted to talk about on Changeling Basics, what are changelings? I'm just going to punt this to Simon because I can answer it, but I know you can. You have a good perspective on their makeup.
So, canonically, changelings are possessed humans. I mean, straight up, that's pretty much what they are. The interesting twist comes in how and by what they're possessed. And to start with the Fae, because they get the most word count, they're European gods or myths that couldn't stand against the rise of Christianity and reason, and rather than die off or retreat into the part of the spirit world that's theirs, they went about acquiring human bodies and affixing themselves to human souls as sort of anchors in the storm of disbelief that was going to totally kill them.
Yeah, that sounds about right. And it's interesting because the nature of that disbelief has changed a little bit over the course of the game lines. We'll get into the overall edition changes a little later, but I think it's kind of worth mentioning how disbelief has gone from... It started out as banality. It was kind of disbelief that was mentioned in the opening of first edition, but it was kind of also just that drudgery of life. A lot of the early sort of banality monster powers were like forcing someone to count to a certain number over and over and over again because that's mundane and so banal. And I get where that comes from, but it's not exactly disbelief. And then...
True.
You know, you had later editions where it was, you know, the crushing burden of responsibility and some kind of disbelief. And then they did a backstory edition where it was really just disbelief. Like, it was humans don't believe in you, and so there are ramifications. Which was clearly meant to be kind of a precursor to how we got to banality. Mm-hmm. It's worth mentioning all the different ways that has been portrayed in the game line. Go ahead.
And you get some really interesting interplay sometimes when you have the different sorts of changelings who have different ideas of what's banal. Like, you have the extremely naturalistic Fae who would consider dreams of going to space pretty banal.
But a knocker that's all about technology might consider that really inspiring. That gets into one of the core mythology pieces of the game. So you have this death of the Fae, slow death, not, you know, wiped out death, over the years as we've moved into a modern era where people don't believe as much. We'll probably talk about history like in detail in a future episode, but in broad strokes, you know, the Fae in the beginning were everywhere and they ran around in their own forms and they were powerful and mythic and they wandered among humans, and then things kind of fell apart in what was called the Sundering, and it got a lot harder to interact with humans safely. That's where disbelief started to come into play. And then the Shattering was when, nope, if you don't find a human and find a way to occupy them and curl up inside of them and hide there, disbelief will wipe you out. And then, in 1969, we land on the moon, and the whole world is inspired by that. And that inspiration brings about what's called the Resurgence, and a bunch of the Fae nobles come back. But technology and science are super banal, at least in the early editions. But us landing on the moon brought back the Fae. It was one of the odder juxtapositions in the canon. And some of these, you know, I know we're opening with some of the contradictions, which is
you know, for a story about myths, not inappropriate, actually.
True enough.
It's also one of the things that sometimes makes the game difficult to unravel. It can also be really fun if you use it intentionally, but it doesn't always feel intentional.
True. So, yeah, you end up with these things that end up having to walk a balance. They have to maintain their human relationships because they are part human, and they have to maintain this really inhuman level of either engagement with myth or artistic inspiration that's really hard to maintain. And they end up being kind of an embodiment of the artist's dilemma. They end up being a really good metaphor for a lot of invisible minority statuses. And that gets into a little bit of the problem with understanding what's going on when you're playing it, because changelings perceive reality at the same time they perceive chimerical reality, and they need to address both things at the same time. And the metaphor I like using for that is, if you're familiar with code switching, they're doing that all the time as a matter of survival, kind of like code switching really is.
Yeah, and code switching is something I actually only came to understand as, I'll say, a sane named concept in the last year or two. Mm. I understood it. If you had described it to me conceptually 5-10 years ago, I would have known what you were talking about. I just wasn't familiar with the term and hadn't had a lot of conversations around it. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, I've thought a lot about that with changelings, and it really is. They're in a constant state of code switching. And similarly to how, you know, and I've experienced this as a gay man, being, you know, a gay man in a room with a number of straight people, or even, you know, a number of lesbians, and then one or two gay men, and I'm having a conversation with one of the other gay men, and we're using, you know, a vocabulary that we know, but no one else does. And maybe there's that moment that someone else realizes and asks to, you know, oh, will you let us in on the joke? And I've never had any impulse not. And, you know, I've had that experience as well, where I'm one of, you know, maybe a couple white people in a room with a bunch of other individuals from other cultures, you know, whether they're other, you know, American subculture or just other cultures in general. And that's fine. It's interesting having that experience from both sides. It's something I've never seen developed in the Changeling books, but it's definitely a compelling part of the game.
Yeah, so you've got that code-switching metaphor in chimerical reality where you have to acknowledge the person you think you are and the person that the world sees you as, and you can have a lot of trouble with that if the person you see yourself as varies wildly from what your human body looks like. And a lot of the other World of Darkness games don't have to deal with that kind of a problem, which makes it a little bit difficult, even for more seasoned role players to wrap their heads around. Because in Werewolf, you are either human, wolf, or one of those things in between, but everybody just uses Krynos. And for Mage, you're always kind of the same thing. But you end up in Changeling having to deal with both at the same time, all the time, unless you're willing to make some fairly painful trade-offs.
Yeah, the other thing that I think sets Changeling aside in terms of those interaction dynamics, you know, beyond just you are this thing, you are a mage, you are a wolf, werewolf, you are a human, werewolf, you are a vampire, is in Changeling, you can go through cycles of death where your fae soul is pushed into a coma. And the interesting dynamic of that is, so you're running around with your friends, you're doing your adventure, you have your standard 5-person role-playing group, maybe. Somebody's playing a troll tank, somebody's playing, the lord, the talker, the face. Let's say you've gone this super traditional route, which Changeling is one of the only games where you can do that. I don't think it's a strong makeup for the game, but it the pieces are there. And then somebody dies. But they don't die. They disappear. Their face all dies. And they'll come back after a while. But during that death, they don't know who you are. They don't know who they are. They reject themselves, which is this really powerful metaphor. But they reject you. And, you know, what do you do in the game while that, if that happens to a PC? Do you just, like, well, downtime for 2 months while they come back to themselves? I mean, that's missing an opportunity for some tragedy and horror. But I haven't really heard stories from players talking about dealing with that. I know we've talked a little bit about how this has come up in your current chronicle, but it's an interesting dynamic, and it's there in the rules. I mean, it's just staring you in the face in the rules. And I think it shows up in a couple fiction pieces, but I've never seen, like, a write-up in the book of, so this thing has happened in your game. How do you deal with it? How do you tap its themes? Like, there, I haven't seen game flavor text on it. I've seen game fiction on it, and the rules are there. So that's, it's interesting.
Yeah, I've always enjoyed using it as a metaphor for trauma more than rejection. Mm-hmm. You've taken this incredible, you know, insult to your self-concept, and it's taking you this time when you're dormant, you're spending it rebuilding that self-concept, and part of that is requiring you to build up to a certain level of glamour again internally, which is why suddenly being exposed to raw glamour can bring you out of it.
Yeah, and it also works for that model. It probably works in that model a little bit better. I think part of why I was thinking about the rejection angle is, you know, so much of Changeling, for me at least, reads as a somewhat queer story. Mm-hmm. You know, with mages, you awaken. And maybe, okay, your family's not awakened, but who cares? You're still a human. Sure, you have these amazing things you can do, but in the early days, you don't even think of them as amazing. You're just really good at something. You know, maybe you get initiated and are an incredibly mystic mage, but for a lot of the awakened, you're just great at HR. As weird as that is for people. It's, you know, there are a lot of mages like that. The things I can do with paperwork with my syndicate mage. You know, in Werewolf, your family is tied into werewolf culture. Right. Kinfolk are an integral part of the tribe. You know, you can tell a story where you were born into, you know, there's only a little bit of werewolf blood and my family is no longer culturally part of it. But that's the fringe story. That's not the core story. And in Vampire, there's no family relations. I mean, you're probably at least 50 or 60 years old, even as a starting PC. There are no, I mean, you're past that stuff. Mm-hmm. Then there's Changeling. And in Changeling, you know, just this moment where the people who know you don't know you, and just thinking about banality rules, where even if another Changeling near you says something or evokes a thought or idea or passion that's kind of rejecting of the mystic, it can impact everyone in the group if it's strong enough, and it certainly impacts them. That coma period can roll over into rejection, even if overall it is a better trauma mm-hmm. metaphor.
Yeah, and part of that gets a little difficult is for werewolf and mage especially, there's a really strong divide between you've got the real world, then you've got the Umbra. And you have to do this intentional thing to access it, which you have to do in Changeling to get into the dreaming. But chimerical reality is always there. Yep. And it plays into this theme of interacting with the invisible, being part of an invisible culture, really. Mm-hmm. Because, like, you may have been born into a family with tons of fey blood, but most of you don't know it. You might yep. be a little odd, but that's really it. There are few changeling souls going around.
The chimerical reality thing, for whatever reason, wasn't something I ever struggled with, but I was that kid that every single recess from kindergarten through, like, God, I want to say like fourth or fifth grade, I was out there spinning my world. I was always doing that as a kid, even when everyone else had grown past it. So that was actually pretty easy for me to grasp onto. I still have an incredibly rich stories running in the background procedure in my mind all the time. But a lot of players I've talked to are like, Chimerical, what? How? But is it there? It's like, well,
yes. But no.
But, you know, I mean...
it's as real as you let it be.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and I've found people that come to the World of Darkness through Changeling do okay with Chimerical Reality. People come to the World of Darkness through the other games and come to Changeling late, even if they do end up staying with Changeling, and those players are less likely to, in my experience. But even if they do, they struggle with Chimerical Reality for a while. All the other little forms of reality, the Umbra, the, you know, Astral Plane, whatever, they show up in different ways in the different games. Like, maybe not every game. You know, not every game has the Astral Plane, but Vampire and Mage do. Not every game has the Umbra, but Werewolf and Mage have it. You know, not every game has the Shadowlands, but actually, no, every game has the Shadowlands. You know, but then there's Chimerical Reality. And, yeah, nobody else has that. Nobody. There's no primer. There's no kiddie pool version of it. It's also worth mentioning at this point that a lot of the stuff we're talking about, Chimerical Reality is true in all editions, but especially the banality, the, you know, rejection of self, belief themes were all really heavy themes in the first edition game line, and that's kind of what we're focusing on. Changeling changed a bit as editions went through. I'd say more than the other games did. Yeah, so one other thing, like the one last thing we haven't really talked about from first edition so much, are the Autumn People, which get back to banality, to a lesser extent, the Dontaine. The Autumn People are basically all the people in your life who just seep banality. You know, your mother who tells you, no, you're never going to support yourself on art, go get a law degree, go become a doctor. The librarian that... There's always the librarian listed in the Autumn People, and it's funny because the librarians I knew in my life were like the opposite of Autumn People. Mm. But an example in the book is always that librarian that's telling you to study more, and I'm like, which librarian was that? I never met them.
Yeah, now a better example of that librarian, I think, would have been the librarian who tells you they don't have the book you want.
And judges you a little for wanting it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah, I did meet that librarian.
Because I've met that one. I've never met the you should study more, what are you doing in the library librarian.
Yeah, it's always weird when I see that write-up. But yes, the description that you're giving, absolutely. By and large, and this is one of the things I find people struggle with, they're normal people. More importantly, they're people that maybe care about you a lot. And maybe you even care about and love them. There was kind of an amazing scene in a webcomic that unfortunately is defunct, but I do recommend it to everyone listening to this, called Chrysalis. And it's set in the 70s, right after the resurgence from the moon landing. And there's this amazing scene with this she, one of the nobles, who'd just come to Earth due to the resurgence. And so she didn't really have her bearings yet, and she ended up in a human body, and that human body had a family and a background and a history, and all her other nobles were telling her, oh no, ignore all of that, that doesn't matter, we're fey, we're elves, we're above all that. And but she loved her father, and her father was just this brutally cold, banal creature. And there's this scene between the two of them, and it's kind of traumatic to read. You know, do you remember that scene at all?
Yeah, I do. For me, I read that scene, and, like, I thought of all the conversations I had with my parents shortly after or during coming out, because that was kind of a tortured process, where it was before my snark had returned, and, like, you get those questions and those comments that come from a place of complete incomprehension that are actually really painful. Like, there was one conversation I had with my dad at some point, which I'm sure he's forgotten, or at least I hope he's forgotten, where he, seemingly apropos of nothing, he said, so you think you're gay, Do you know how those people have sex?
Oh.
And it was one of those moments where, like, as a fully formed adult with defensive mechanisms, I can go into gross, gory detail about how straight people have sex and make it just as shameful and gross as he wanted to make that.
Yeah, and as long as we're telling, you know, family stories to reference the Autumn People, I had a much tamer version of that, but in a way more insidious. And this gets to what often makes the Autumn People dangerous. Like, sometimes it isn't that blatantly offensive comment. I had someone who was obsessively stalking me at school, like happens in high school, and I thought I could get rid of her by being honest about my sexuality. At that point, I thought I was bi, and I told her that, and it did not make her go away. And she had, you know, someone call my mother, and she did not make this call. She had someone else call my mother and ask if, you know, ask my mother if I was bi. And when my mother unsurprisingly said no, because I had not had this conversation with my parents yet, I was like 16, you know, the response was, "Think again, bitch." Three words that will live in my mind in a very specific location for all time.
Yeah.
And the conversation that happened after that, love my parents. My parents love me. My parents want the best for me. We have a great relationship around my whole family now. But when I was 16, it turned into the, "Well, have you ever done anything with? Well, okay, you might just be curious." And like this whole drawn out, very carefully, like, described, you're at the age where everyone's experimenting and you shouldn't, like, close yourself off. And like, I'm bi, literally, all my options are open. What are you talking about? You know, it was this response as though the idea that there was any part of me that was attracted to other men meant that I'd, like, fixed there, and they just so meticulously took it apart. And not in a vicious sort of way, but just, like, they were defending. And I know now they were defending because that idea in their own mind, but I had to be there and listen to it.
Mm-hmm.
The weird thing about this, and to get back to changeling metaphors, would have been about 2 years later, maybe three, when I came out, and I had a boyfriend at that point, and I was in freshman in college, and we had, you know, the conversation that we moved forward from. You know, I referenced that conversation. I was outed by this, you know, asshole who called that I was bi in high school, and they went, "What are you talking about?" And I went,
"Oof.
What?" And I, like, went back through parts of that conversation, and neither of them could remember it at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I gave up. I went, "Okay. All right. That conversation never happened in your world. You peeked past the mists, and your mind coped and erased it. And that's terrifying. But we're in a better place now, so okay."
Yeah. And that gets into kind of the last thing that sets Changeling apart, too. Because you've got the mists, this force that has no volition of its own, that only exists to erase the memories of people, normal people, big air quotes, who interact with things they'd rather not, and just makes them forget. This is the other really painful part of that experience, because you may have a defining moment with somebody that they don't remember next week.
Yeah, yeah.
On the flip side, though, like, if my dad doesn't remember that conversation we had when he was having his, "Oh my god, my son is gay" freak out, honestly, that's kind of a win.
So the thing for me wasn't that I ever wanted to revisit that memory again. I really didn't. It was the fact that they had erased it. And I was happy that I never had to have that conversation with them again, but the fact that they had erased it was telling. And it's telling in a very similar way in Changeling about the relationship that the person that has forgotten that part of you has with that aspect of your nature.
Getting back to the gay metaphor, like, people who briefly experience the Fae, they have to reincorporate and synthesize this new idea of this person, and they might not be able to sustain that. And in the end, do they kill the person they hoped the changeling was, or do they accept the person the changeling turns out to be?
And that becomes really complicated. I think, you know, getting back to the world of Stormy Pinkness comment, I think I've had this conversation multiple times with multiple people where they're like, oh, Changeling is this lightness in fairy tales and, you know, make-believe on the playground. It has no place in the world of darkness. And we'll start a conversation, either one-on-one, or I've had these conversations online where multiple people are involved. And by the end of the conversation, I will say something, and they'll be like, no, this has become more nihilistic than Wraith. Like, I can't play this. Like, it's gone from I'd never play it, it's so fluffy, to I don't need this kind of trauma in my life. I don't ever want to play this game. And it's, I think part of the reason for that, I was watching the first episode of Legion with a friend this past weekend. The first episode is in an insane asylum. And it has some Changeling corollaries in terms of dynamics. It's not really a Changeling story. But we reached this, he was having a really hard time following. It's a very surreal, very messy series. But around the end of the first episode, you get into like that scene in the insane asylum that you get to where things go wrong and the orderlies come in and everyone's, what little agency they had in the common room is just stripped away. And he went, I can't watch this. I can't watch this. I have to leave. And he left the room. And he's always been someone, he's the person that gave me that World of Stormy Pinkness quote. And I went, oh, nope. Your relationship with Changeling makes sense now. It's not that it's not horror. It's that it's a horror you won't look directly into because it's been part of your life. And I've run into that a lot with Changeling. The books don't always highlight the horror. Sometimes the books are very Arthurian questing myth goodness. But when you get into the horror is that thing your parents put you through that year when you were having a rough time in high school. That horrible conversation with your parents when you come out. You know, the first guy I ever had a crush on was sent to straight camp.
It's realizing the police aren't necessarily there to help you.
That night, Ulf went before the Duke to petition for freedom to pursue the dragon that had slain Annika. The Duke listened to Ulf's request, then shook his head. There are many reasons I cannot grant this, Ulf. I have already lost one of my best knights. The beast has gone now, wandered off again to who knows where. Even in defeat, Annika has accomplished her guise. The dragon is gone, is it not? I cannot countenance your trespassing on the lands of another. Other lords and ladies may not take kindly to the presence of a brave warrior, and he said this with a patronizing smile, such as yourself invading their freeholds. Serve, and be content with that. May I ask you one question, my Duke, before I return to my duties? The Duke waved his hand magnanimously. I grant you this boon. Ask. Why did you charm Annika against taking protection from dragonkind? A hush fell on the court.
In second edition, the game refocused itself away from the power of your family that loves you but doesn't understand you to the resurgence conflict where the Fey nobles came back to Earth and began to impose the order of the world from which they exited, where they started to put a feudal system onto all of the Fey who had seen revolutions and had lived through multiple different versions of those revolutions where humanity had decided to cast off monarchies and despotism and move towards more equanimous manners of government. The Shi came back with the full force of magic that hadn't been seen on Earth in 300, 400, 500 years and completely overpowered the commoners, and that's most of the friction in the game from there out.
Everything you read from that point on is kind of, are you a loyalist? Or do you hate the Xi? Even the write-up on the Nunahi, who are the Native American fairies. They use the term fairies, they don't use the term fae. The Native American fair folk. And I say Native American, they are broken down by tribes. They actually do a surprisingly good job of not committing the Orientalist sin with the Nunahi, which I appreciate. But they even get pulled into the resurgence conflict, because so much of it happens in North America. And they had just kind of come to, like, a quiet truce with the commoners, like, okay, I guess we'll deal with this equilibrium. Just leave us the hell alone. And then along come the Xi, and that falls apart.
Yeah, I wish there had been some word count given to the American Indian movement, because it happened at about the same time as the resurgence conflict, and it would have been a really good thing to use for the narrative.
It really would. There's... I love the idea of the Galen, and for those listening, the Galen is the term for all non-Arcadian fae. Arcadia is the magical home deep, deep in the dreaming that they come from. Yes, Arcadian is a Greek term. Yes, the fae come from the UK. Hand-waving, we won't talk about that until a later episode. But yes, that is as awkward as you think it is. You know, most of the time the Galen are fae from other cultures. Sometimes it includes some European fae as well. Depends.
Gets good and confusing.
I mean, mists, changeling. Like, it wouldn't be changeling without that. Sometimes I even think they do it on purpose. You know, I love the idea of them. And like I said, like with the Nunahi, they do a really good job of not painting all native cultures with a single brush, which is not a small accomplishment. While at the same time, they never really get integrated into the story. There's a little bit in one or two of the North American flavor books about events that they are included in, and I do like those sections. But it's never from the point of view of their culture. You know, and the Nunahi probably get a better treatment than the Asian Fae or the Polynesian Fae, which are the other two big group.
The treatment the Nunahi get is better than World of Darkness typically does without groups, but...
It is.
Yeah. Just reflecting on it a little bit, it plays into some pretty strong myths that white culture has about Native Americans generally. At the same time, written before the internet was really a thing,
mm-hmm.
But... It'll be really interesting to see where they go with it, and hopefully a small amount of revision happens, if nothing else.
I'm hoping that they get a book they're the center of. Now that, you know, we're seeing production on Changelings start again, I think they need that. The only Galen that ever actually got a standalone book were the Asian Fae, and a lot of Changeling fans don't think they're Changelings. That actually came up, at least half a dozen times in the Changeling 20th anniversary Kickstarter. Comments being like, okay, the Hisian are cool and all, but they're spirits. Like, let's not kid ourselves. And I was like, this is comment 8 from 8 different people saying that. So, there are parts of that book I like. It could be better integrated with Changeling. And a little less Orientalist.
But getting back to the Xi,
yes.
during the interregnum between the Shattering and the Resurgence, they had retreated to Arcadia. The fiction treats it differently each time it comes up. Sometimes they have memories from when they were in Arcadia, sometimes none of them do. It's implied that something bad is happening in Arcadia, but maybe not. And some of the Xi came back and were obviously banished, others elected to come back. And all of that may have been intentional. But you end up with these spirits arriving on Earth, and in order to protect themselves from the hostile environment they find themselves in, they immediately steal a bunch of bodies, which puts them in pretty stark contrast to the commoners and most, if not all, of the Galen, who have undergone a kind of fusion with humans. The Xi pretty much just tore the soul out of a body and then jumped into the empty space left behind.
And this gets into a really interesting dynamic as well, because those Xi don't reincarnate. You know, normally when a fae soul dies for the last time in a lifetime, you know, I talked about kind of their short comas. But when
the body dies.
When the body dies. And sometimes body dies with the face all awake and they reincarnate. Sometimes they went through a particularly hard coma and they're just going to be asleep for the rest of this lifetime because that person is deep enough into their own move away from belief that they can't support an awakened, you know, a crystallized face soul anymore. But then when they finally die, then, you know, the face soul gets to reincarnate into someone else. The Shi don't reincarnate. They don't come back. And they never say that it's because they didn't do the changeling way properly. There are kind of two interpretations. Well, there are three. The third one being what the Shi think about that situation. And everyone who reads that in canon and just as a player reading it goes, oh, that's cute that you guys think that. Their belief is we're returning to Noble Arcadia when we die after spending our time fixing the world. And it's like, oh, that's nice that you think that. Yeah, the other two options are, you know, they screwed up the changeling way and did it violently and inappropriately, or they were just fresh out of the dreaming and can't handle the banality of the world and don't survive the reincarnation process. Those are kind of the two interpretations I've seen.
Right, and there's a little bit in the 4 or 5 splat books for the Shi that goes into, like, the ones who acknowledge this is an issue and will, you know, cope with this information, some of them go off in really weird directions with it, where they decide to completely embrace banality in order to inure themselves to it. There are those Shi who go the other way and decide to wrap as much glamour around themselves as possible in order to keep aging away, live a more traditional fey life, as it were. And you end up with some really, really messed up dynamics falling out of that, where the Shi, because they are rightful rulers of whatever land they survey, impose taxes on other changelings and take dross from them, which is material glamour, in order to protect themselves from something. Then you just end up with the huge mass of Shi who refuse to accept that this is a thing that happens to them, and that they will either go back to Arcadia or reincarnate, because that's what changelings do, obviously.
Well, of course.
And they end up being a really good examination of our own tendency to fear and repress the fear of death without actually having dealt with it. They're rarely played that way.
Well, yeah, so... Yeah, that gets into, there's the game as it exists, there's the game as it actually integrates into the world of darkness, and then there's the game as it's played. And they're kind of actually three completely different games. You know, the other thing that I find interesting about the Shi, and this gets into the half-truth inconsistencies that they might be doing on purpose, because Mist's an unreliable narrator. Unreliable narrator is true news throughout World of Darkness, but it is really central to Changeling, and intentionally so. So you never really know if their inconsistencies are on purpose or not. They set up this one house of the Shi, House Skathak. And Skathak stayed behind when the rest of the Shi fled when the Shattering happened. You know, the noble Fae went, oh, screw this autumn, winter hellscape and all of this disbelief, we're going back to Arcadia. And the Skathak, for a variety of reasons wrapped up in their backstory, decided to stick around. Most of them did. Not all of them did. And they became normal changelings, and they reincarnate, and they don't have the banality problem, sensitivity problems that other Shi do, which is great. And then I was reading other Shi houses recently, and in House Dougal, they talk about, oh, there were Shi that stayed behind and became changelings with the other commoners, but they eventually all died, a reference to the fact that the Shi don't reincarnate. But then you read Skathak, and the ones who stayed behind and became changelings the proper way do reincarnate, and House Dougal talks about their collaboration with Skathak in the Dougal write-up, and it's like, wait, why aren't there Autumn Dougal? Why do we not have, like, huh? And, yeah, so... exactly what role does she play, and, like, how much of the story of, like, how the houses interacted actually play out from a sort of rules how things work in the world way in a consistent manner, they really don't. It's strange.
Yeah, you can do a lot of hand-waving around, Skathak did the changeling way properly, and the returning nobles, they were too wrapped up in their own superiority and their need to be able to consider that there might be other ways to do it. Sure, that works. But then you deal with, like, House Fiona, which the she who stayed behind from that house did so because they had ties to humanity.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you'd think that they would have figured the trick.
I think this is one of those things they didn't worry that much about developing, because I think they never intended to do a backstory line for Changeling the way they did for the other games. The other four of the big five games got a historical setting. And that's aside from the Dark Ages line, like an actual standalone historical setting. And Changeling never did, and I don't think they ever intended to. I don't think they were ever going to do an interregnum setting because they couldn't imagine not devoting enough word count to the she to make a Tremere cry in the corner that he's being ignored. Like, how could we do Changeling without making the Tremere lament their lack of word count? you know, so...
Which is a shame, because Changeling has this great mechanism for examining the past and the remembrance background, which is the ability to recall your past lives.
Mm-hmm.
And they never actually contextualized it.
I've run a game in the Interregnum. I know you're running a game right now in the Interregnum. I think there's just brilliant potential there. And the way I tend to run it is the Skathak remain behind in numbers. The other houses left a few behind. And, you know, even in New York, are you going to find more than, like, maybe three she in the Interregnum in all of New York? No, you're probably not. If you're in a Chicago or even a San Francisco, maybe one, maybe. And they're not going to be flaunting it because that makes enemies. When I did my Interregnum game, and it was a con game, it was a standalone, I built an effect basically around the she stay hidden during that period because they have a target on their back otherwise. But if they use their power, because there are these, you know, deep, powerful dreams about them, if they're not careful, it erupts in chimerical reality, and anyone who sees them is suddenly flooded with remembrance about what they are, and, oh, look, target.
Right, and they're a target because...
Because they're ridiculously, you know, powerful, and that makes enemies, but they don't have, you know, hundreds of them around to collaborate with. I mean, when the Shi come back in force, they beat the commoners down. But you know the council of, like, 12, 13 commoners running Chicago is going to look at one she and be like, nope, no, no, we're not giving this up, not at all. You know, and one she isn't going to win that fight.
Right. The thing they ran into during the Resurgence War was the she made up about 5% of the changeling population in America, and they won.
Now, to be fair, that was in part because they have a whole storyline around loyalists and non-loyalists. So it was the 5% of the Shi who have a really broken version of Dominate. Really broken.
Yes. Do what I say or kill yourself on the inside.
Yeah. And then they had the majority of the trolls.
Plus they also had the Trod Network, which didn't exist until they came back.
And no one else knew about it or knew how to use it safely. It's a compelling story. Part of what's weird about it is you have this whole first edition, and it's all about banality and, you know, personal relationship and your humanity tied to this alien nature and all this stuff. And then you get to second edition, and it starts to look very Arthurian. It starts to look very modern, gritty D&D. Unless you stop and you go, this is about oppression. Just like with the rest of the world of darkness, this is about the world we live in and abuse and power structures and the dreams of feudalism we refuse to give up. Like when you look at our current politics in America, when you look at people that don't really, you know, they do surveys and they find people don't really want political choice. They don't really want democracy. They don't want to have to understand. They want to be told what to think and believe and do. Suddenly the Xi do take on a horrific glimmer. And
which really puts off the players who love playing the shiny Xi Knight.
You mean like 80% of the player base?
Yeah.
Yeah. So this gets into Changeling integrating with the World of Darkness. I love integrating Changeling with the World of Darkness. I tend to pull the Fae out in my non-Changeling games a lot. It sometimes gets on my players' nerves. Sometimes they love it. People that really go for that Arthurian mythology, that it doesn't tie in quite as well.
Yeah, and I tend to keep Changeling a little bit more siloed because I storytell Changeling for the sake of doing Changeling. I don't work it into other games as much, and I don't almost ever work other games into Changeling. But it's because I like exploring the themes of Changeling, and Mage can do that. The other ones don't do it very well. Maybe Wraith.
Yeah, maybe Wraith.
It's easier to bring a Mage or a Wraith in service of you're dying. You're basically human than it is to bring in a vampire or a werewolf, because they're both killing machines.
I've never pulled the Fae into a vampire game, I don't think. I take that back, once in high school. And that was because I had a player that was being a real... But yeah, that's the only time I pulled it into vampire. I don't run werewolf. I mostly use it in Mage. I haven't run enough Wraith to get the chance. I'd love to do a Sandman Changeling integrated game. I think there's a lot of potential there, but that is a hard sell to find players for.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to find the horror. Like, it's hard to find the horror in this Arthurian stuff.
You get some of the same touchstones, because, like, the bit at the end about Arthur and Mordred and Morgan Le Fay is kind of Fear of Death-y, but really it's not. It's mostly about how good things can never last, which is really a very different theme.
It is. I do think, especially if you pull in Morgan Le Fay, especially if you pull in the Galain, I think there's a lot of potential to merge the two, to be, okay, you're dealing with all these weird, complicated politics. What happens when the Xi start to, like, worm their influence out into the mortal world as they think is their right? What does that look like? I mean, on one hand, they're ancient, politically capable creatures that in a lot of ways make most modern vampire politics look quaint. You know, modern changeling politics aren't as complicated as, like, Dark Ages vampire politics, but most modern vampire politics are not all that complicated, really. And so if the Xi start getting involved and they have the benefit of the mists, there's a huge power trip there. Like, there's a huge potential for nuance and complexity. And how does that feed back to them? You know, don't focus on the vampire aspect, but, like, how does all this stuff interact with their banality, weakness, and losing themselves and the tragedy of, you know, trying to recover them. What happens if a Xi becomes a Dantain, which is a Fae, which is a bastion of banality? When they described the Dantain, they didn't really go into how Kiths become Dantain. Just like, here are different types of Dantain in absolute terms. You know, I think there's actually some really meaty territory there. There's never really a book about it.
Yeah, and getting on the a Xi trying to influence mortals or other supernaturals in the World of Darkness, you run into the problem of what you do with that Xi having been locked up in their freehold for too long.
Mm-hmm.
Because lack of contact with the real world divorces them from it, and they go mad. What happens when the CEO of a mega company starts to believe that everybody's out to get them?
There's some really meaty potential there, you know, even if the CEO of the mega company is a weird, reclusive shadow CEO that doesn't come into the office because they would die, but they run things from a far-off place. There, you know, there's certainly some stories about that, that, especially in the World of Darkness, it feeds into a certain interesting paranoia, especially if you're running Changeling in, like, a league setting, if you're doing, like, LARP Changeling in one of the big club environments, and you're running Changeling, but your actions roll out and influence vampire games two states over, etc. you could start to do some really interesting things with that while still having your game be all about changeling. But yeah, it doesn't get touched on a lot.
In his wanderings, he turned corners randomly. He was searching for an empty doorway or a cul-de-sac where he might curl up out of the wind and nod into a restless sleep, untroubled by other homeless or gangs that were attracted to the sport of beating the helpless. At least the shelter folk gave me a name. Niall. Something to call myself besides street bum. He laughed bitterly and thought dimly, as if spying on someone else's memories. He recalled a war. A battle. A feeling of... what? Fear? Anger. Sadness, perhaps. Yet the picture slid into a misty haze, too unstructured to make sense of what he saw. He was younger then, he thought, and more resilient. He stood another moment, trying to force himself to recall lost details, to remember who he was. Finally, he bowed his head. His shoulders slumped, and he surrendered again to the gray opacity that was his past.
We've talked a little bit about this. We kind of wanted to pull everything together at the end and really talk about how do you bring first edition and second edition together and focus on themes that are, you know, really central to Changeling. And really, what is the identity of, like, the whole product, the whole line, you know, in these different things it's been. I'm curious, because I talked a little bit about, you know, World of Darkness. How do you tackle with actually integrating the themes of the two editions, since you've definitely done more running of Changeling than I have?
In my current game, for example, the mission statement at the outset was to play a cross Fae Nunahi game where some of the players were playing European American spirits and some of the players were playing Native American spirits, and having to navigate the political, cultural, and spiritual differences of those two groups in order to deal with the problems that might come up from being in close proximity and dealing with the problems that NPCs throw their way. And what I've run into just trying to incorporate those two parts of Changeling together has been that you really end up with people who decide they want to focus on one or two things, and they ignore the hooks you throw their way for other things. Our game has gone pretty deep into kind of personal development and spirituality territory, probably because most of the Fae players dropped out, and we were left with Nunahi, who were interested in appealing to their totems. We also incorporated Nightmare, which is an optional part of second edition Changeling, I think. But we ended up with this really interesting dichotomy where on the one hand you had the spiritual journey of the characters, and on the other hand you had the influence of neurosis and trauma represented by the nightmare system. And I actually had a moment at one point where a player told me that she was considering that her character might be developing a phobia. And I was like, hey, do I need to back off pushing this button with your character? And she was like, no, I'm super into it. We should dive into this.
Oh, that's when you know you have a good World of Darkness player.
Yeah, and we've ended up... Her character's been a really interesting case because, on the one hand, all of her nightmare has been spent on a fear of doctors and aging and decrepitude, which is normally a banality theme. And she's actually been very careful about acquiring more banality to the point where it hasn't really been an issue yet. Mm-hmm. But she's still hammering on the same core theme that Changeling really gets at, that you are diminishing and you have been diminished. And what do you do to either deal with that or avoid it? I feel like, especially because the she's weakness is being especially susceptible to the influence of banality, which is that diminishing force for them, that there's a really strong tie between the two different editions there, at least, even if the Shi impose a different sort of conflict on the game.
Whatever they do with Nightmare in Changeling 20th, I'm probably going to end up treating it the way you've been treating it in this Chronicle. For people listening, because I'm sure we'll talk about this Chronicle more, Simon's actually doing a Changeling Interregnum game using the Dark Ages Fae system that he's really heavily modified to bring into more Changeling the Dreaming themes. I got to do one cameo appearance. We don't live in the same city. And it was stellar. It was a really stellar game. So, yeah, that's some of the stuff like Nightmare, when he's describing it, it's a pretty modified version of the system.
To be fair, the Nightmare system in second edition is the better part of a page.
Which is, you know, actually not bad word count for one system. And Changeling is a small core book, partially because full color, so they didn't get as many pages. But one page isn't terrible.
Well, Glamour got like 5.
Yeah, I mean, Glamour is pretty central, but yeah, I'm hoping in the new 500-600 page tome we're getting, Nightmare gets some more attention. If it's a more central rule, fingers crossed.
The thing I ran into with Nightmare that I disliked, at least as written, is that it's sort of a reverse bunk. Bunks are what you do when you're trying to activate your magic. And most people golden rule that one into being, like, your material components or the poem you have to read in order to do something. And as written, bunks are just kind of a terrible random imposition on what you have to do because, lol, glamour's random.
Bunks were one of the things they leaked in the Changeling 20th Kickstarter. And I like the framing of it there, where the purpose of the bunk, a bunk has to be visible. You have to expose yourself to the world. And what you're doing is specifically invoking awareness of humans, who are the ones who dream, and exposing yourself to that and making yourself vulnerable and invoking their creativity. Even if they're not enchanted, even if they can't see you for what you are, some part of them will recognize what you're doing. You know, if you're a rabbit puka and you're beating your foot against the ground like a rabbit, like Thumper in Bambi, some part of them will resonate with that, and that awareness boosts your magic. I think that framing is better than it got in previous editions. Some of the examples they give, though, very much have the same problems that previous editions had with bunks. And again, I haven't run the game as much as you have, but I'm revving up. I want to run it when C20 comes out, and one of the things I want to do is say, okay, like, the spindle prick in Sleeping Beauty, the Rumpelstiltskin name thing, the sorts of things that were done to enhance magic in fairy tales, that's what I'm going to expect of you. If you moon a crowd, the police will come for you and it's not going to help your magic. You know? I'm sorry. I feel like bunks have so much potential to add flavor, and this is a bit of background that I know because I've chatted with some of the old White Wolf game devs online. Bunk system. In first ed, I don't know if they originally intended bunks to be in the game at all. I think they probably did. They thematically make sense. They're present in fairy tales. But the way the bunk system was done in first ed included cards, and you like had a hand of bunks and you pulled the one that was appropriate to the cantrip you wanted to do. It was cumbersome and weird and no one liked it. And no one knew why they designed it. It didn't bear any resemblance to previous designs. They got kind of a bad rap for a while for like, oh, you were just trying to be too edgy. Turns out what had happened was that was just as magic had gotten huge.
Magic the Gathering.
Yeah, Magic the Gathering had gotten huge in the industry, and I think, you know, maybe Vampire the Eternal Struggle had come out and a couple other card games, and their distributor told them, you will build a collectible card game element into this or we will not carry it, because that's kind of how distributors were back then. They strong-armed, and they wanted to make the most money they could, and some idiotic marketing person at the distributor that didn't actually understand how games worked thought that would, you know, coattail on this trend. And because none of the developers actually wanted to do it, like, I think if some developer had had a cool card idea, they could have done a card thing, and maybe it would have been fun, but you can't tell a creative person, do this thing because I said so, and expect a product you want to, like, that's worthwhile. It just doesn't
work. You end up
with
a lot of banality.
You end up with a lot of banality, which is ironically what the bunk cards ended up being. That bit of background, as much as that helps, they got rid of them in second ed. Bunks lived on, but they felt more like the changeling version of Mage Paradigm.
Bunks are fun.
Yeah, they can be fun. Yeah, I've definitely seen some bunks that are pretty cool. I've also seen some bunks, especially when you're like in the middle of an action scene. You're like, what can I do in the 2.5 seconds of this combat action that isn't going to be the magic effect itself? You know, and you just watch players seize up, and it does more to detract than it does to add. I hate those moments.
When I played Changeling more, I often had to, like, when I was character making, make a list of things that would go with the arts I took. Like, I made a saner I never used, and saning is the art of using words and names. His whole thing was like, I think there's like a saning spell that lets you make a shield or something. And I was like, this is his only combat power. He has to be able to pull it out in combat. I'm just going to have him carry around a bunch of rocks that he's written runes on that he, like, throws out to make the shield. And it's the dumbest thing, but it's like, what are you going to do?
I mean, that actually has a certain fairy tale resonance to it. I can think of stories I've heard where, you know, fair folk did things kind of like that. It doesn't, I mean, and so that's the other thing, something we were talking about earlier. Changeling kind of stands alone, you know, and we've criticized it a fair bit. This is one of the things I love about it. It stands alone in the world of darkness in being full of kind of the wonder of magic. You know, all the world of darkness glorifies this idea of magic, and this mythic age is this great thing. But Changeling is the only game where it's like, no, really, give in to, like, childlike, wondrous eyes about that. And that kind of thing, like, I have this stone rune, I'm going to throw it, it's going to make a shield. It just feels quick and vital, and it feels like something you've heard in a fairy tale. You kind of, like, get a good feeling about that, and then you have to face losing it, which is where the horror comes in. A lot of the players never make it to that second step. You know, a lot of the other games I end up playing, you know, and it's just kind of like nihilistic, like Wraith, like, oh, well, this is terrible. I like Wraith, but a lot of times it's like, oh, this is just terrible. You know, Changeling is the game where your setup is, cool, you love being you. Now let's take that away.
Yeah, Changeling is a lot of that feeling of, this was great, I am never going to let this go, because the second I do let this go, everything comes unraveled. And that clutching gets to be part of the problem they have. Especially the she, but everybody else. Because they close themselves off to new experiences that might be just as good for the sake of holding on to that one candle that's giving off a tiny bit of heat.
And I think that is a lot of what can draw Changeling into the other games, give it a place in the world of darkness, because that feeling actually presents itself over and over and over again in the world of darkness. That's where the common thread is. I was having a conversation with a friend who's like, oh, and he wasn't a big fan of Changeling at the time. He was like, oh, if I win the lottery, I'm going to buy World of Darkness, and I'm going to develop the four games, and then I'm going to pull in Changeling Lost instead of Dreaming. And I said, hold on there, buddy. I get it. You may not like it. But Changeling the Dreaming is the ultimate culmination of the entire Mythic Age die-out theme that started in Werewolf and continued through all the other games. And Lost just isn't that. It has no place.
No.
Like, it's a nice dark game in its own right. If you like those themes, it's beautifully developed. Think about Changeling in that place. And he was like, oh, you're right. I'm like, yeah. You know, werewolves feel that way. For different reasons, vampires feel that way. And mages. Mages and changelings. They have the most in common, as weird as that is.
Well, they're both partly human. Mostly human.
Mostly human. And they both do a whole lot of weaving of reality, just in different ways.
There's that element of tragedy that Changeling's kind of wrapped itself around and then candy-coated as a defensive mechanism against it. And I think superficial readings of the material and some of the writing really lends itself to only looking at the candy-coating and ignoring that there's that kernel of existential dread that is overtaking everything else in it.
I think that existential dread is really important. You know, when I've played with players that get that, I have really fulfilling experiences, you know, and I can't say I haven't had my ridiculous fairy tale changeling sessions, especially when I was younger, that I enjoyed. I wouldn't necessarily want to play those anymore, but, you know, and I've actually seen a conversation online where, you know, we were talking about the horror of changeling, and a lot of us were talking about examples from our games, and someone said, this is all tragedy. None of this is horror. And I wish that I'd had, like, I'd had the thoughts formed better in my head at the time, because later I realized, but what's horror? Like, horror is that thing you're terrified of, and you find things to be tragic, and maybe you're terrified they're going to happen to you.
Horror is when tragedy happens to somebody else.
You know, we've made a lot of the Arthurian references tonight. Or I guess I've made a lot of Arthurian references tonight. It's a lot of Arthur in the game. There's also a lot of Shakespeare in the game. You know, they make a lot of direct references to Shakespeare and his idea of the Fae. And then you get, you know, some random stuff about much older, animistic, almost godlike Fae myths and framings. But the Shakespearean angle is often very tragic. You know, and when you think about the types of stories he liked to tell, there's a lot of potential there. And there's a lot of potential to play out the death of amazing things, and at the hands of really well-intentioned people. I think that's the kicker, and that's probably the most important thing from the first edition, to pull forward and really get your horror themes, even if you want all the high Shakespearean, Arthurian politics. Pull forward that the most dangerous people probably love you, and that's terrifying. You know, you can't murder hobo them. Not really. Not without completely compromising the narrative.
Mm-hmm. And you can't use your magic to solve the problem because they are banal. They have an inherent defense against you.
Even if you do, even if you push through that banality, the mists are going to hit them. They're going to have these traumatic memories of you. It's going to compromise what relationship you do have with them. And everyone who's had, like, that terrible relationship with a parent or a sibling where you love them, you don't want to cut them off.
But you don't like them either.
You don't like them either. And so it's like, sometimes you cut them off and that's healthy. Sometimes you, like, power through it and make the relationship as healthy as it can be. Sometimes you actually fix things. You know, I had a really screwy relationship with my sister when I was younger. I have a really good relationship with my sister now. But sometimes that's not possible,
mm-hmm.
You know?
And sometimes you end up with the best relationship possible is the one where you are as far away as possible. But sometimes mm-hmm. you write letters.
Yeah. But if you're in that place where it's like, oh, I even want to still be able to write letters, you can't magic your way out of it. You know, you hopscotch, primal gimmicks your way out of a situation, and they convince themselves they didn't see what they just saw too many times in a row, they're not going to have anything to do with you. So, yeah, and it can be weird. People aren't used to getting that call, hey, mom's dying, in the middle of a role-playing game, and have that be a major plot point. Hey, mom's dying, you love her, but she's an autumn person. That could be a major changeling story. And if mm-hmm. it interrupts your Arthurian epic at a critical moment, then that's kind of how those pieces can come together, and how the real world invades. And, you know, wrapping it up in tragedy, really kind of central. Like, that's what makes changeling work.
The Shi especially, their politics and their high adventure is really a way to distract themselves from the mundane. Mm-hmm. It's how they make their glamour, and it's not entirely functional.
No, it's really not. It's really dysfunctional. I've seen some hints and glimmerings online that we're going to get a lot more of that when the next edition comes out, and I have my fingers crossed. I'm hoping for a lot of that.
One of the things germane is a way to bring those two themes together from the different editions is to consider the Mists of Avalon, which is in a lot of ways a high tragedy.
Oh, yeah.
It's also quintessentially Arthurian, and you end up with a lot of the same themes. You have the past clashing with the future, you have tradition and magic dying on the steps of a new religion, you have a conflict between men and women, you have a conflict between doing what is right for a family, not being what is right for a country or a kingdom. A lot of that plays on both sets of horror.
I would definitely agree. I mean, that's all set in a medieval setting, but when you think about ways that would kind of manifest in a modern world, yeah, I think that's one of the best references for Changeling. Most of the other Changeling references, like good media I've seen, they're fun, they're awesome, they tap themes, but they tend to fall into the sort of epic cycle of I'm going to go wandering into the dreaming. Little Prince, Mirror Mask, those sorts of stories, and they're cool. But the wandering into the dreaming thing doesn't work for long-term Changeling Chronicle. So while I like them, I think you're probably right, Mists of Avalon is probably better like core story source material. I think we've done a pretty good crash course on Changeling. The next episode will definitely dive into something a little more specific within the world of Changeling, but I feel like this is a more comprehensive intro than a lot of people end up getting to the game, unless you're kind of determined enough to go through a few of the books, at least. Thank everyone for listening. I'm really excited to start going through these podcast sessions and get some of the ponderings that Simon and I have out into the world.
Thank you all for listening, and I hope you will listen to our next episode. The readings from this episode were from The Enchanted, Changeling the Dreaming 2nd Edition, and War in Concordia. The music from this episode was LSD by Mon Plaisir, You, Yourself, and the Main Character by Komiku, and Rennerdine, performed by Alistair Thompson. Remember, if you think you're being hunted by the Fae, turn your jumper inside out. This won't make you invisible, but the Fae will be embarrassed to be seen with you and find more fashionable prey.